We'll spend the rest of the hour talking about segregation in the United States. It still hangs on. It was allowed by law for a very long time. And more than that, it was the law, and not just in southern states with their Jim Crow laws. The federal government did not just allow segregation in housing, preventing black Americans from living where they wanted. The federal government caused segregation in housing. Our next guest wrote two recent books on the topic. The first was The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard Rothstein is the author of that book and its successor. Richard has long studied, written about, and spoken about education, inequality, and segregation. He's a fellow of the Economic Policy Institute and had a long affiliation with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. With his daughter, Leah Rothstein, he wrote the follow-up to this book called Just Action. We visited with her in July of 2023, and now Richard Rothstein is our guest. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
It seems like the prevailing view is that segregation happened because the law allowed it to, but you certainly take things a step further in this book, and it seems like this wasn't hard to discover.
Not at all. The reason we're segregated as a society is because of racially explicit written public policy by the federal government and state and local governments as well that insisted that African Americans and whites could not live near one another in any metropolitan area of the country. This is an unconstitutional system. The notion of de facto segregation is utter nonsense. It wasn't something that just happened in fact. It was something that happened as a result of explicit government requirement. And that's what The Color of Law describes. And then the sequel to that, Just Action, describes what we can do about it now.
Now, there was the Fair Housing Act passed in 1968. Before that, was there nothing on the books that could have been used to break up segregation under law?
Oh, no. The policies that government followed were unconstitutional and unlawful. They violated the 14th Amendment long before, since 1868, not 1968. They violated the 13th Amendment since 1865, and they violated a Civil Rights Act, which was adopted in 1866, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, that only in 1968 did the Supreme Court recognize was a valid law that prohibited any form of second-class citizenship, any form of discrimination against African Americans. It was a racially explicit law. It said that the formerly enslaved people and their descendants had the same rights in every area, public and private, as white people. And this is a law that was ignored by the federal government for 100 years, and as well as the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. So these were unconstitutional policies. And theme of Just Action is that because they were unconstitutional policies that created racial segregation, that all of us as American citizens have an obligation to participate in remedying them.
But the remedies, you say, don't include litigation, or litigation cannot provide a remedy, you write in The Color of Law. Why?
Well, litigation can defend remedies, but litigation can't provide the remedies themselves. What's needed is a reinvigorated civil rights movement that will implement these remedies, and that then will obviously be challenged, because there are people in this country who want to challenge any form of racial equality and who want to deny the plain meaning of the 14th Amendment that provided equal rights in both public and private spheres to African Americans. So they'll be challenged. But it can't start with litigation. We need people in their own communities to take action in their own communities to begin to redress segregation. You know, the fact that the federal government was the primary mover in requiring racial segregation doesn't mean that the federal government is the beginning of the solution. Because once you have segregation like we have in this country today, there are many, many policies and programs that at the local level, that reinforce, sustain, and even exacerbate it. And so there's many opportunities for people in local communities in Southern Oregon and Northern California to take action that can redress segregation. And there are so many of these possible programs and policies that we describe in Just Action that if people start to do that, pretty soon will make a significant impact.
Richard Rothstein is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Color of Law and co-author with his daughter Leah Rothstein of the follow-up to it, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. We are live. We have Richard to the end of the hour. If you want to take part, send an email along to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to stick with the legal end of things for just a moment and just indicate what the thinking has been through the years. There's one court case in particular you highlight early in The Color of Law from 1974 involving attempts to desegregate public schools in Detroit, and you take then-Justice Potter Stewart to the woodshed. What did he get wrong, in your view?
Well, he claimed that the suburbs of Detroit did not play any role in the segregation, the concentration of African Americans in lower-income areas in the city of Detroit itself, and therefore desegregating the metropolitan area was not constitutionally required. What he ignored is that these suburbs were created as whites-only places by the federal government. In the post-World War II period, the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration embarked on a program to move the entire white working-class population and lower-middle-class population out of urban areas into single-family homes in all white suburbs from which African-Americans were prohibited from participating in this program. These suburbs were created by the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration all over the country, in California, in Oregon, as well as the rest of the country. In The Color of Law, I described some places in California where this happened. I also use as the biggest example, the one I give most detail to, is something that many of your listeners have heard of, Levittown, east of New York City.
Where I spent the first 13 years of my life.
Okay, all right. Well, I grew up not far from you,
huh.
But many years before you, I'm afraid. Levittown, 17,000 homes. You apparently lived in one of those 17,000. Levitt, the builder of that project in the late 1940s, couldn't assemble the capital in the private sector to build that project. No bank would lend him the money to do it. The only way Levitt could build that project was by going to the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administrations, requesting a bank guarantee, a federal bank guarantee for his loans to buy the land and build the homes. The federal government gave him that bank guarantee on condition, explicit condition, that he never sell a home to an African American. The Federal Housing Administration even required Levitt to place a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. This was a federal government requirement, and it was true of the suburbs that were created in Detroit, as well as in Southern Oregon and Northern California. Actually, in my book, The Color of Law, I describe a white project on the north side of Detroit, all white, mm-hmm. that was funded by the federal government. And there's a photograph in my book of a six-foot-high, half-mile-long concrete wall that the Federal Housing Administration required the builder, as a condition of issuing him the bank guarantee, required the builder to construct in order to separate his all-white project from the rest of Detroit, because it would otherwise run the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups. That's what the federal government said. This was written policy. The federal government issued a manual to appraisers all over the country whose job it was to approve or not approve the federal government guarantees for loans to developers who wanted to build these projects. The manual said explicitly that you could not recommend for a federal bank guarantee a loan to a developer who was going to sell to African Americans, and the manual went so far as to say that you couldn't recommend for a federal bank guarantee a loan to a developer of an all-white project that was going to be located near where African Americans were living.
So as we look at this with your help, it appears that what we refer to as white flight post-World War II is really more like white siphoning by the federal government.
Yes, white flight is a very misleading term. It implies that whites were motivated by racial animus to leave urban areas or inner ring areas because African Americans were moving in. This was not how it happened. Typically, now we're talking about white flight, not so much about the creation of these suburbs themselves, but about white neighborhoods, typically at the outer edges of urban areas where African Americans started to move in. African Americans were willing to pay more for homes in these neighborhoods than whites were willing to pay, simply because of supply and demand. There were so few houses that would be sold to African Americans that they were willing to pay more to the few people who would sell to them. So if you had a white homeowner in a white neighborhood in the outer ring of a city, and the family wanted to move, maybe the husband got a better job at the time, or maybe they had a bigger family, it was in their interests to sell to an African-American because the African-Americans were paid more. Well, once that happened, something called blockbusting occurred. Once a family bought a home in a previously all-white neighborhood, an African-American family, realtors and the real estate agents descended on that neighborhood to frighten the white residents that their neighborhood was going to be destroyed by African-Americans living there, that they would lose their property values, and that they would leave. And they sell before it's too late. If you don't sell now to us, your property is going to be worth even less. The white, the real estate agents used scare tactics. They did things like hired young white women to move to walk around the neighborhood pushing young black women to walk around the neighborhood pushing baby carriages. They hired young black men to drive through the neighborhood with their car radios blasting. They went so far as to have a black real estate agent knock on people's doors to terrify them that the African Americans were moving into the neighborhood. And pretty soon, these real estate speculators were able to sell the homes at a higher price than the market value to African Americans who were desperate for housing, and then buy them from frightened whites for far below the market value. Whites virtually had no choice but to leave, or else they would lose all their property values. This wasn't a voluntary system, and we call it an unconstitutional system because every one of these speculators was licensed as a real estate agent by state government in violation of state government's obligations under the 14th Amendment. So white flight certainly existed. That is the leaving of whites, but it wasn't something that was initiated by the homeowners themselves. It was something that was manipulated by government that licensed these real estate agents and by the private sector real estate agents themselves.
Did anybody, I mean, there was an NAACP, there were lots of other organizations back then in mindful of civil rights. Did anybody take any of these things to court?
Well, they attempted to. In The Color of Law, I actually document this. I talk about a suburb in south of San Francisco where this kind of blockbusting occurred, and the actual leading speculator who moved into that neighborhood, set up an office to frighten whites into leaving, was the president of the California Real Estate Board, a civil rights activist at that time. It was in the 1950s, the mid-1950s, protested to the state licensing agency, and the state licensing agency said that the racial discrimination was none of its concern. So there were attempts by many people to protest this kind of system, but the government was persistent and insistent on the maintenance of segregation.
We've talked about a lot of work post-Second World War to create these all-white suburbs, Richard, but back up a few years before that, because the feds did build some housing and New Deal programs under the PWA, the Public Works Administration, and did it also take a role in segregation?
Yes, it certainly did. As I indicated, these FHA and VA programs that suburbanized the white population weren't the only government programs that created segregation. Most people, I think, most of your listeners, certainly it's true of me as well, misunderstood what public housing was in this country and its history. I always thought that public housing was a place where poor people lived. That's not how public housing began in this country. The first civilian public housing in this country was built during the Depression in the New Deal the Roosevelt administration, and as you say, by the Public Works Administration. And everywhere it did this, it created segregation by separating whites and African Americans. Separate projects for whites, separate projects for African Americans. Most of the initial public housing projects were for whites, and they were not for poor whites or poor African Americans, because they were designed for people who could afford to pay the full rent of housing, but for whom no housing was available because we were in the Depression and very few little construction was going on, so the housing shortage was going greater and people were desperate for housing. Well, the federal government embarked on a program to build the first civilian public housing in this country for this predominantly white but also black populations in separate projects everywhere in the country. And as you mentioned in your introduction, this wasn't in the South. It was everywhere in the Midwest. Well, I say everywhere, but, you know, the government wasn't thinking about the South, about the West, I'm sorry, about the Pacific Coast during the Depression. That was too long ago for them to begin thinking of the West Coast. So it built public housing in the eastern and midwestern and southern parts of the country, maybe a couple in the Southwest, segregating them. In The Color of Law, I refer to the autobiography of the great African-American poet, novelist, playwright Langston Hughes. He wrote in his autobiography that he grew up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood. That may be surprising to your listeners. It was to me. We don't think of Cleveland as being an integrated place today, but we're much more segregated today than we were in the 1930s. He said, as Langston Hughes said, that in high school, his best friend was Polish. He said he dated a Jewish girl in high school. It was an integrated high school and an integrated neighborhood. The Public Works Administration went into that neighborhood, demolished some housing, and built two separate projects, one for whites, one for African Americans, creating a pattern of segregation with that and other projects elsewhere in the Cleveland area that reinforced whatever informal segregation patterns existed. And made them virtually permanent and lasting to this day. And this is also true everywhere that the Public Works Administration built housing. Later, the Public Works policy was succeeded by a Federal Housing Act, and that also built segregated housing into the 1930s and 1940s.
Richard Rothstein, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his books on segregated housing pushed by the government, aided by the government, insisted upon by the government in some cases, The Color of Law and Just Action, which is a more or less how to implement what you find in The Color of Law. You can join us with emails to jx@jeffnet.org. You point out that after the Second World War, the housing shortage you just described reached crisis proportions. President Truman proposed new public housing. Talk about the maneuvers in Congress to subvert the bill's intent and what ended up happening.
Well, I don't know that it subverted the bill's intent. It was always understood that public housing was going to be segregated. You know, I really got my start in this field. I didn't remember it for a long time, but in the early 1960s, mid-1960s, I was a research assistant at the Chicago Urban League. And I was young then. I didn't understand much of what was going on, but my assignment was to go into the basement of the big public housing project there, one of the big public housing projects there, the Robert Taylor Homes, and go through the archives of the Chicago Housing Authority, because civil rights lawyers had had a discovery order that permitted them to examine the archives, the correspondence of the Chicago Housing Authority into the 1940s, the period you're talking about, the 1950s. And what I found, and a couple of other young assistants found in going through this correspondence, is that in an explicit policy, the Chicago Housing Authority and the Chicago City Council created public housing projects for whites in white neighborhoods and for African Americans in African American neighborhoods. It was an explicit policy. The lawsuit that resulted from that, eventually, it was called, for those of your listeners who are familiar with this history, it was called the Gautreaux suit, G-A-U-T-R-E-A-U-X. The Supreme Court found that the Constitution was being violated by this policy of segregating public housing in the city of Chicago. As a result of that suit, the city of Chicago just stopped building public housing, and that's how the Section 8 voucher program began. It was a substitute for public housing because the city was unwilling to continue to build public housing if it couldn't segregate it.
So public housing has such a bad name in this country today. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the creation after the Second World War of things like the Robert Taylor Homes, Cabrini-Green, Pruitt-Igoe in some of the major cities. And these are standing as examples to show why governments should not be involved in directly creating housing. What avenues remain then as we switch from the color of law to just action? What should the general public be demanding to get people fair housing that is colorblind?
Well, I have to say that you just mentioned the Robert Taylor Homes. That was the project whose basement I spent the hot summer in, digging up these data. What happened was that public housing authorities made a terrible mistake, and this was not racially motivated, this particular mistake I'm talking about. It was well-intentioned, but it was disastrous, and we are repeating the same mistake today. What public housing authorities decided in the late 1940s and 1950s, and they did this all over the country, was that nobody should be permitted in public housing who could afford housing in the private market. And if you recall, we talked a few minutes ago about how public housing was initially designed only for people who could afford housing in the private market. So what they did was they evicted all the middle-class, working-class families with good jobs, decent jobs, who could afford to pay rent out of public housing, so that public housing in the late 1940s and 1950s became a place where we concentrated the poor, concentrated the poorest people in one place. And, of course, those projects became dysfunctional. I describe, I think, in The Color of Law that it was, before that time, the maintenance people who worked in those projects and got decent jobs, the construction workers. They made sure that those projects were maintained while they were living there. Once they were evicted, there was nobody else who cared as much about keeping those projects in good shape. Once they were filled with poor people, government stopped investing in maintenance and in keeping them in good shape. So they became dysfunctional. And then you got the thing like the destruction of public housing because they were so dysfunctional because nobody but the very poorest people without good jobs, without access to good jobs, were living there. We're making the same mistake today in our housing policies. We're building concentrated projects for low-income families. The biggest public housing, the biggest federal program now to subsidize housing is called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. And instead of building projects which are mixed income, what we're doing is we're building projects for the poor alone and creating the same kind of disaster that we created with public housing before. This is not this new project, this new program, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, is not public housing exactly. It's a tax credit for private developers to do it, but it's having the same effect. There are many, many things that local people can do at a local level to redress segregation, and that's what the book Just Action is just about. I know we don't have much time, but let me give you one example. As I said, the federal government created this housing, but the opportunities to redress are local. In virtually every metropolitan area in the country, the property tax system is racially discriminatory. Because once you have a segregated system, you can have race-neutral policies on their face, which are discriminatory in effect. So African-Americans who do own their homes pay property taxes at a much higher rate than whites who own their homes do. Well, how does that happen? It happens because county assessors and city assessors who assess the property values of homes and residences, and this affects the renters as well because the landlords are also affected. They don't do a reassessment every year based on trying to match the assessment to the market values of the homes. They do it once every decade, perhaps, and then they adjust the assessments by some common factor, inflation or the housing market. Well, over time, properties in white neighborhoods appreciate in value faster than properties in black neighborhoods do. There are a lot of reasons for that, but that's just a reality. The result is that it doesn't take too many years after an assessment. And like I say, there are jurisdictions that may do an assessment only once a decade, once every two decades. Over time, the property values in white neighborhoods exceed the property values of black neighborhoods by a greater amount. That means that the assessed values in black neighborhoods are closer to their real market values than the assessed values in white neighborhoods that are far below their market values. Well, the result of that is that African Americans are paying a higher tax rate relative to the market value of their homes than whites are. They're paying a greater share, a burden of paying for schools and libraries and fire departments. Well, this is a purely local issue. It's a local expression of what was a federal policy of segregation. But it's a purely local issue, and it's something that local, what we call in Just Action, a reinvigorated civil rights movement, can address. But it's not going to be addressed unless people create local committees to press for it. Assessors recognize this. This is not a mystery. Assessors admit, and in Just Action, we actually spend a good bit of time quoting the Cook County assessor, the one who supervises Chicago, admitting that he's operating a discriminatory system. But nobody's going to force him to change it unless local citizens get involved. So that's just one example of the kind of thing that can be done locally to redress what is really a federal system.
It sounds, Richard, and we have 1 minute left, basically, that what you're talking about is the need for more mixed housing, mixed in color, mixed in income. But we tend to self-segregate, don't we? And we want a bigger house with other bigger houses, that kind of thing?
Well, we self-segregate because the system permits us to self-segregate. What happened was many suburbs created zoning laws. Once these suburban locations appreciated in value so that working-class people, middle-class people could not move to these suburbs that they could have moved to had the federal government not prohibited them from doing so if they were African-American, the suburbs created zoning rules that prohibited the construction of duplexes, triplexes, anything but single-family homes on large lot sizes. Those zoning rules were designed to perpetuate a segregation that was initially created by the federal government, and there are, as you know, movements all over the country to attack those zoning rules and permit the construction of duplexes and triplexes. But that's a separate issue from creating mixed income and mixed race housing. Because if you simply change the zoning rules, we have such a housing shortage now in this country that affects both blacks and whites. You know, middle-class whites can't afford housing either in the suburbs where they grew up. Mm-hmm. So we need to have much more race-conscious policies that ensure that not only we build more housing and more dense housing, but that we also make sure that they are mixed income and mixed race.
All right. So much to take in and not nearly enough time to talk about it. The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, Just Action by Richard Rothstein and Leah Rothstein about segregation produced by the government. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Take care.